had shorts. They have been today.
You what?
Representative Schumacher, welcome to the committee. I am not going to officially move House File 3833 since we don't quite have a quorum, but we will momentarily. So we're going to go ahead and let you start presenting the bill because all of our favorite members are already here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And we are awaiting the commissioner to help with the testimony on this bill, but we will get started here. The elder financial exploitation bill that will be in front of you shortly is the result of several years of work between stakeholders. It allows for investment advisors and broker-dealers to insert themselves when they reasonably believe that financial exploitation may be occurring to pause transactions and investigate before it's too late. With us today is the Department of Commerce and Robin Rowan to walk you through the bill.
Welcome back to the committee, or welcome to the committee for this year, I'm not sure, but anyhow, please identify yourself to tape and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Megan Verdea, and I'm here on behalf of the Commerce Department. I'm a legislative liaison there, and I know our commissioner is on her way, so hopefully she'll be here shortly to answer follow-up questions.
And it's my fault for jumping us out of order, but we were looking for a bill that would take a little bit more time since we didn't quite have quorum.
Absolutely. But I can walk you through the bill real quick here. And we want to thank Representative Schumacher for presenting this bill today. It's a very important piece of legislation to protect our seniors and vulnerable adults from financial exploitation. At the Commerce Department, we protect consumers from fraud and financial exploitation through outreach, education, consumer assistance, and enforcement. As you know, the Commerce Department received resources last year specifically to address senior fraud prevention. The Hang Up on Fraud campaign has already reached thousands of Minnesotans, seniors, caregivers, and loved ones through presentations, communications, and social media. Facebook ads alone resulted in over 1 million impressions this past year. Common types of fraud and exploitation we are seeing are investment fraud and affinity fraud. It is estimated that 52% of elder fraud abuse cases are perpetrated by family, friends, or caregivers. This bill helps us partner with our financial professional industry and provides a tool to try to prevent fraud and exploitation before it happens in the first place. The Minnesota Commerce Department registers broker-dealers, those in the business of buying and selling securities, and their agents, as well as investment advisors who make investment recommendations. In Minnesota, we have 2,093 broker-dealer and investment advisor firms and over 161,000 individual broker-dealers and investment advisors. Financial professionals are in a unique position as a trusted advisor and familiar with clients' long-term financial goals to help identify and prevent financial exploitation and fraud. A recent case reported to the Commerce Department demonstrated the need for this legislation. Common staff received a call from a financial advisor who was worried that one of her clients was being financially exploited. Her client came to her and said she needed to cash out her annuity because she had won the Costa Rica lottery. But first, she needed to pay the taxes before she could receive the winnings. Knowing this was fraud, the investment advisor called our department for help. Unfortunately, the advisor did not have the authority to stop the transaction from happening, so she had to let it go through. At the point our investigators were notified of the fraud, we had staff contact the client to confirm that this was a scam. Unfortunately, the client still did not believe she was falling victim to fraud. Due to our strong relationship with our banks and financial institutions, we were able to contact the client's bank and convince them to stop the transaction from the bank side. Thankfully, the transaction was stopped, and further discussion with the client, she came to realize that she had not actually won the lottery in Costa Rica. In this case, we were able to limit the damages. But there are countless other cases that go unreported or where investment advisors and broker-dealers are helpless to stop these transactions. This proposal would give them the tools. The legislation is designed to better protect seniors and other at-risk individuals' financial exploitation by equipping our financial services professionals, namely broker-dealers and investment advisors, with new tools and encourage them to make reports and referrals to appropriate agencies, including the Commerce Department. This legislation has five core features. First, the Safe Seniors Act allows financial professionals to report when they reasonably believe one of their clients is falling victim to financial exploitation. The report may be made to Commerce and the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, or MARC. Second, the Safe Seniors Act establishes procedures for the notification of third parties of potential financial exploitation. Broker-dealers and investment advisors may disclose information about the suspected financial exploitation to a trusted third party, except when the third party is that suspected of the exploitation. A third party, such as family member or other trusted individual, may help seniors or vulnerable adults take a closer look at transactions. Third, the Safe Senior Act gives financial professionals the ability to temporarily delay the transaction or disbursement of funds to protect vulnerable adults and seniors from financial exploitation. Allowing financial professionals the ability to hit the pause button on a transaction could mean the difference between financial health or financial victim for a client. The Act provides broker-dealers and investment advisors with the authority to temporarily delay a transaction or disbursement of funds if the firm reasonably believes that such transaction or disbursement would result in the financial exploitation of the eligible adult. Fourth, the Safe Seniors Act requires the broker-dealer and investment advisor share records related to exploitation with law enforcement and other adult protective service agencies. The Act includes provisions that will ensure appropriate access to the records of broker-dealers and investment advisors by investigatory agencies in cases of suspected or attempted financial exploitation. This provision is necessary to facilitate and help agencies while maintaining the confidentiality of personal financial information. And finally, the Safe Seniors Act provides broker-dealers and investment advisors that comply with its provision civil and administrative immunity for reporting notifications and delays. Seniors are not by definition vulnerable adults, but we do know that seniors are targets of financial fraud and exploitation. And while a senior can spend his or her hard-earned money any way they choose, this bill also lets us partner with a financial advisor to help protect their economic future. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you, Ms. Verdeja. You did a nice job. And we'll have Ms. Rowan come down, and then we had somebody else, Mr. Burke, after that, and then hopefully the commissioner will hear. Ms. Rowan, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, and I'm here today on behalf of my broker-dealer and investment advisor members. I believe this is the fourth year, I think, that the Department of Commerce has brought forth a similar proposal, and so I want to thank the Commissioner and Megan, especially for this is the first year that they've really sat down and worked with us and found a proposal that works for all parties. I also want to thank Representative Schumacher for his patience. It's only year two for him. And Representative Hillstrom, as always, for her expertise in this area. One of my members, Allianz, conducts a survey called Safeguarding Our Seniors. And one of the things they found is that the average loss to a senior from financial abuse is $36,000. And that is, for over half the respondents, that constitutes a major loss or financial ruin for them. And what we've also found is that once your money goes to the Costa Rican government, it's gone. It's almost impossible to get it back. So we feel it's imperative that those on the front lines have the tools. So if they have a reasonable belief that financial exploitation is taking part, that we have the tools to investigate, to report, and protect the client's account. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rowan. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know approximately how many times a year this happens where your folks would want to report and pause these transactions?
Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, it's relatively rare. I think the Commerce Department has some actual statistics from other states they can share, but I understand from my folks it's relatively rare that you get to the point where you would want to put a hold on a transaction.
Representative Hillstrom? Members, other questions? Representative Luna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to thank Representative Schumacher also for bringing this bill forward. I had met with the Commerce Department. They've got a couple of things going, the unclaimed property. And when I took a look at this on their website, I actually checked in my district, and I went to three different senior groups and presented. And in each of the three senior groups, every single senior had been approached or had the move put on him regarding fraud, and I currently have a client of mine who's dealing with his father, and his number is not $36,000, it's $52,000, and that money is gone. And you can shut it all down, but there is no way to recoup that money. So doing something proactive like that for these seniors who probably are vulnerable because of their politeness, if they answer the phone and they don't just hang up on people, it is a real problem. Plus, when it happens, in the case of my client, his father was so embarrassed he didn't want to tell anybody what he fell for. And it was finally when he changed the addresses and the son ended up with some of the mail that he came in and got involved in it. And so it's kind of a complicated situation. It's hard to watch.
Not seeing any other questions right now. Mr. Burke, you want to come down and identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sean Burke, and I'm with the Minnesota Elder Justice Center. We're a statewide nonprofit organization, and we work with victims and their families who've been victimized, abused, neglected, or financially exploited. We also train law enforcement, financial industry professionals, medical professionals, and others about how to prevent harm to elderly and vulnerable adults. By best estimates, nearly 5% of Americans who are 60 years of age and older will find themselves victim to financial exploitation this year. Minnesota has made great strides in alerting the public the importance of reporting suspected abuse and financial exploitation. The Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, otherwise known as MARC, has made continual improvements since its inception in 2015, and it can accept reports from anyone in the community. Still, lack of reporting is a problem. Research indicates that most exploitation goes unreported. The National Association of Adult Protection estimates that nationwide, only 1 in 44 cases of financial abuse are actually reported. The adult protection professionals in Minnesota that our organization collaborates with stress that those in the financial industry who work with seniors, they can play a role in stopping exploitation before it starts. Whether it's your personal banker or a teller at a credit union, they are in a position to see something, and under current Minnesota law, it allows those bank employees to say something without fear of reprisal. Public policies like the bill before us today encourage reporting of suspected exploitation can prevent abuse. We are in support of the commissioner's efforts and efforts of all stakeholders to continue to improve public policy, and specifically Section 6 of this bill, to ensure that the proper investigative authorities are working collaboratively and legally. The goal of any of these types of policies is to encourage reporting from those in a position to see it, to ensure that the correct agency gets the case, to promote interagency cooperation, and to keep appropriate due process safeguards and protection for reporters. Financial exploitation, as we just heard, is often a private tragedy, but there are public costs. On a regular basis, our advocates work with seniors and their families who've lost their ability to pay for medical care and basic housing costs because of financial exploitation. They require, for example, health care from public programs long before it would have otherwise been necessary. These crimes, of course, also rob the victims of their dignity and has been linked to poor health outcomes. Not one bill is a cure-all. And in addition to the adjustments to this bill, in future years, we hope the legislature takes a bigger and more important step of supporting education initiatives around reporting. As example, it's not just scams. Financial exploitation is commonly perpetrated by loved ones, caretakers, family members, especially when they can gain access or control over a senior's finances. Research indicates, therefore, that knowing how to report is just as important whether one is required to report. Still, we applaud this step towards empowering financial professionals to report and stop exploitation before it does irreparable damage, and we encourage its passage this session. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Representative O'Driscoll had a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schumacher, thank you for this bill. I think it's a very good bill. Just a quick question for you. Does this bill involve in any way, shape, or form any interstate commerce pacts?
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll. As far as I'm aware and having reviewed the language a few different times, I would very confidently tell you that no, there are no interstate licensure compacts in this bill.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schumacher, given the fact that fraud does transcend state boundaries, you may want to consider that in its future legislation.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, to the author. Two things. One is, how do we treat the privacy of the data of the individual once we start getting other people involved? What kind of protections are in place for that individual?
Representative Schumacher or... And Representative Halverson, I had this conversation earlier with Representative Hillstrom before we started, but we are sending this bill to civil law. And I don't know if you're on civil law, but we have a little more leeway and latitude. So we'll go ahead and if we don't get the complete answer, I'm sure that Representative Hillstrom will get that in civil law.
It's the bottom of it. I have another question, too, while somebody's figuring out what to answer.
Sure.
Okay. Go ahead.
Commissioner Rubin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is an effect of hubris when you try to time things at the legislature. It doesn't quite work out right.
You forgot to count in the fact that I jumped out of order. My apologies.
I apologize, and thank you for allowing Megan Verdeja, who I heard did a fine job in presenting this bill, so thank you for letting her do that. And again, it's a privilege to be in front of the committee. To answer the question, the same privacy protections that are provided in the current MARC legislation are in this piece. They're carried over to this piece. And then we are also going to civil law, where there will be conversations specifically. We've got a couple of tweaks on how to fix some of the specific data practices laws that we'll be working with the author on. So we're getting there.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Halverson, is that...
I have one more question. A separate question. So can you clarify to me the process from the consumer's point of view? So a broker agent might have a concern, goes through the hold process. Is the person whose account it is notified that there's a hold, or how are they involved in the process on their end?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, they have to be notified. Well, typically they're going to be involved in the transaction. I think it's really important, and I'm sure Ms. Verdeja mentioned, as did Ms. Rowan, that and the author, that obviously the presumption is that this money is your money. It's the money is the person that it's their money. They've worked hard for it, and they can spend it however they want. And so this isn't about preventing people from doing what they want to with their money. This is about trying to help prevent and address financial exploitation. So the person who is involved in that transaction have to be involved in that decision, and they are also notified and have to be notified under the bill.
And Representative Hillstrom, I assume you have a question at this point, but before you do, we now have a quorum, and we've been discussing the bill for, I don't know, 15 minutes or so, primarily on the DE2 amendment. So I will now go ahead and move the a bill, House File 3833, so it is properly before the committee. And Representative Schumacher, we have been largely talking about it, but I will also move the DE2 amendment, and I assume that's just author's amendment to get the bill in the shape you want. It gets been out posted for 4 or 5 days. So with that, we've already had questions on it. But those in favor of the adoption of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The DE2 is amended to the bill as amended. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, thank you. Members, I'm no longer a prosecutor, but I prosecuted financial exploitation of vulnerable adult cases for my 7 years at the Anoka County Attorney's Office. I was their primary prosecutor. So I believe that I know something about this issue. And I have raised issues about this bill with the commissioner, and the DE2 reflects a number of those. And so many of the issues that I was going to bring up in the Commerce Committee, I won't be bringing up. But there are some public policy decisions that have to be made, and so I'm going to talk about those, and then I'm going to highlight a couple of civil law issues so that she's ready for civil law on Thursday. So, members, one of the pieces that's in this bill that is a policy decision that not all states do is they put an age in this bill. You now can have the transaction stop solely based on someone's age rather than their vulnerability without someone making a determination first about whether or not they have the capacity to make that transaction. 20 states have moved in that direction, not all states. Many do it based on the person's capacity. The question is, should it be based on age, should it be based on capacity, or should it be based on the transaction that's being perpetrated, right, a known fraud. There are any number of policy ways to do that. This one does it based on age, and I have fundamentally been opposed to doing it arbitrarily based on age. A number of CEOs of Fortune 500 companies are largely over the age of 65. By putting an age in the bill saying you can stop a transaction solely based on age, I worry about that very much. Our governor is over the age of 65. Our president is over the age of 65. Many members of the Minnesota House of Representatives are over the age of 65, and we allow them to make public policy decisions still. And now we're saying we can stop a transaction if we're worried solely based on the age. The second piece that's in the bill that will be a policy decision about age is it isn't just the account holder, but it's the account holder or on line 3.6, an account where the person over 65 is a beneficiary. So if I have an account and I'm going to be 50 in June, but my 65-year-old parent or older is the beneficiary on the account, they can stop the transaction on that account under the language that's under this bill. Those are public policy decisions that this body is going to have to debate and make a decision about. One of the things I appreciate, they're going to make all the reports through MARC. So thank you for that is now in the DE2 amendment before they were going to go to Commerce. I want all of the transaction problems to go to MARC and to the Department of Commerce. Because if you don't go to MARC, law enforcement doesn't find out about it, adult protection doesn't find out about it, and if you just go to the one agency, that assumes this is the only problem transaction. In every case that I've ever seen of financial exploitation, it isn't only a credit card, or it isn't only the bank, or it's all sorts of places. You're seeing many transactions, and I worry if just one entity gets a hold of the proposal without everyone being able to look at all of the transactions. So thank you for going to MARC. The pieces that are going to be a problem in civil law as we talk about the next stop is on page line 4.6. It talks about the court of competent jurisdiction being able to make decisions about the delay in the disbursements. You have a piece where you allow an interested third party that was involved in the initiation of delay. I don't know who that is. Is that a child? Is that so? Now you have a competent adult over the age of 65 that now an adult child can bring something to court. We're gonna have to figure out who can continue to stop these transactions if we presume that people are competent to make decisions about their money unless we take away their rights. We have to think about who can continue to stop that. And then the records section on line 4.24 starts that the investigative agency. I'm fine with the immunity that the brokers want. I'm fine with that. I'm fine with them delaying a transaction when we figure out which transaction should be delayed, and I'm fine with them getting immunity. But under the records section on line 4.24 is where it starts. If they disclose records to the Department of Commerce or the government without the account holder's consent, it's a violation of the United States Constitution. You are allowed to be free from illegal search and seizure, and you may, in fact, be keeping someone from prosecuting a case if you've gotten records without the owner of the account's consent. And so you're going to have to put something with a search warrant or an administrative subpoena to get these records, because otherwise the person who owns the account is the one that has the right to say you can have them or not. What if they don't want to cooperate? You know, what if they say it's my son and I don't want to cooperate with the criminal prosecution of my son? You got to take care of that provision. And then the last one we already talked about on line 5.1, you talk about civil investigation, and I think it should be both civil and criminal. The Department of Commerce has the ability to do full criminal investigations. They have the full authority of law enforcement. They actually have licensed peace officers in this state, and they should be bound by the other rules that we require law enforcement to be bound by. So the real question that this body, this group, has to decide is, when should you stop a transaction, right? Who's the burden on? Do we get to stop it first and then prove the person who is capable to say, no, this is really not a fraud, it's really, really not a scam, I really want the transaction to go forward? Because there is no process in this bill for me to challenge that freezing. There's no process in this bill. The question is, should there be one? And then should age be what it's based on? And then who can continue that stoppage? So Those are my issues with the bill as it stands. We've been in conversations for quite some time, and I assume we'll continue to be in those conversations. At the end of the day, we all want to protect seniors, but we have to make sure that we respect seniors, too. So that's all, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Commissioner Luman, did you
Mr.
want to
Chairman,
respond?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, thank you so much, and thank you for working with the department and stakeholders and the author on this bill. And all of the things that you've identified have been very helpful in making it an even better bill. And I do want to reiterate, and we've talked about this as well, is that the presumption here is that the transaction will go through. But to your point around investigations and actual prosecution of the fraud, that's a separate investigation that we'll need to be make sure that we have all of the appropriate language around those components and the transfer of records. But again, I want to reiterate that, you know, this is a tool to help us prevent senior exploitation and the exploitation of vulnerable adults in from financial fraud and scams, and it's not a solve all. It's not a silver bullet. It's not going to fix all of the problems, but it's one more way that we can work with industry. We can partner with trusted advisors that we can help identify and prevent on the front end financial exploitation of seniors. And then also, we already currently are, and we will continue to do the enforcement and the criminal prosecution of financial exploitation when we find it. So there's a lot of really good things in this bill, and we'll continue to work on the civil law components of it to make sure it's in the shape that it needs to be in for that committee.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think thanks, Representative Hillstrom, for those really good points that were brought up. It did raise a question for me. I think the age issue is an important one. However, one of the things I think we need to consider as we're creating this policy is that we're trying to deal with a population that's being targeted based on their age, and targeted very successfully, I would say, by scam artists. I feel like we have tools in the toolbox now that aren't very effective in terms of finding out where the source of these scams are coming from, alerting seniors, making sure that we give the Attorney General the ability to go after these scammers, but they're tough to find. Costa Rica and lottery is tough to nail down. We do know that people are being targeted based on their age, and so in some way it feels like having a discussion about the age in this policy is really important. I think that hearing from the folks who represent the seniors would be the most helpful thing, because I believe in the nothing about us without us policy, and I'm not a senior yet. In fact, seniors are getting younger every day, as far as I'm concerned. So, but I think that would be the most helpful thing, is to make sure that the seniors who are raising concerns about the fact that they're being targeted based on their age should have an input in deciding whether or not an age goes into the policy.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Commissioner Luman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Halverson, we've worked really hard with the senior advocacy groups, and I hope that you'll see in your packet letters of support from several senior advocacy groups who have identified that this bill is really going to help those that they serve. But you're absolutely right. This wouldn't work, nor would it be appropriate if we weren't working closely with those advocacy groups to make sure that we were serving the people that we're trying to help.
Thank you. And at this point, is there anybody else in the crowd that wants to come down and testify on this bill? For or against? Any hard feelings towards the author? Anything like that? not seeing any. Oh, a lot of hands going up. Hang on. Not seeing any other member questions. With that, Representative Schumacher will give you the final word.
Thank you, members.
That's brevity. We like that. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3833, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Thank you, Commissioner. Please come back and visit often. It's nice to have you here. And with that, we'll move on to the next bill. Representative Hamilton. Life is all about timing. Come on down. I will move House File 2013, and the motion will be that we refer the bill to the Committee on Jobs. And there is also an A1 amendment. I assume that's an author's amendment?
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
I will move the A1 amendment as well. Those in favor of the adoption of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hamilton, welcome to the committee to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This bill simply eliminates the conflicting and confusing language in state statute on accessibility of public buildings. It does not change Minnesota Building Code, Mr. Chairman. And I do have a testifier, and I'd like to turn it over to the testifier at this time.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Margo Indicross. I'm an accessibility specialist with the Minnesota State Council on Disability. For over 44 years, the Council on Disability has served as a technical resource for legislators, state agencies, and the public on issues of disability policy and accessibility. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 2013 and the A1 Amendment and seek your support on this housekeeping measure. Our goal is to eliminate language in Statute 326B.106, Subdivision 9, that has caused confusion over the years and has been used as a rationale for noncompliance to other state and federal laws that do require physical modification of a building for the sole purpose of providing access to people with disabilities. Both the Minnesota Human Rights Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act require that if access for people with disabilities cannot be achieved otherwise, reasonable modification to the built environment must be completed for the sole purpose of providing access to people with disabilities. The building code is quite clear as to when access is required, and the amendment we are seeking will not change the building code. What the amendment does do is eliminate redundant, poorly worded language in state statute that has caused confusion over the years and unfortunately delayed and in some cases may have denied access for our community. Thank you for your support.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Hamilton?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to add that the A1 amendment further clarified the intent of the bill, and the Department of Labor and Industry, Department of Administration, and the Minnesota Council on Disabilities preferred that language, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Not seeing any member questions right now. Is there anybody else that wants to speak on this bill, for or against? If not, Representative Hamilton will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, ask for your support.
Thank you. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2013, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Jobs and Energy. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Thank you, ma'am. Next up is Representative Howe, House File 2899. I will move 2899, and the motion will be to send it to the General Register. And Representative Howe, you also have a DE3 amendment, which I assume is an author's amendment. I will move the DE3 amendment while you're rearranging furniture. Those in favor of the adoption of the DE signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Thank you, members. The motion is adopted. Representative Hamilton, Howe, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Actually, I've got some oral amendments, if it would be.
Hang on a second. Representative Davis, have we killed the bill yet this year?
I think we're about to.
Okay. Representative Howell, let's see what you got.
On lines 1.11.
And this is to the on the DE3?
Yes,
the DE amendment.
Mr. Chair. On lines 1.11, delete explanation and insert notification. And on line 1.13, delete explanation and insert notification.
So, Representative Howe, I think what we're going to do, well, Ms. Bambu, is it better for us to reconsider the amendment and then vote on it with his oral amendments in it, or just vote on the oral amendments? What would you prefer?
Chair and members, I think it would be best just to vote on the oral amendments, seeing as we've already adopted the DE.
All right. Those in favor of the adoption of those two short oral amendments signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Howell. The oral amendments are adopted to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. All this bill does is it notifies both The residential contract, it makes the residential contractor and the insurer or the adjuster notify the insured that you cannot use, your deductible can't be included in the contractor's bid or initial estimate. So that's all it does. And
and Representative Howell, it looks like you have a testifier.
I have a testifier, yes.
Welcome to the committee, ma'am. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Tracy DeLean. And I am the chair of the Contractors Association of Minnesota, and I'm also a licensed contractor. What Representative Howe is proposing is basically an iteration. It is against law in Minnesota to waive deductibles. So if there is a property claim, you cannot, as a contractor, I cannot waive the deductible. What we would like to do is also have that same statute on the claims package from the insurance. When you have a claim, that it would then be on that documentation as well. So both the contractors and the insurance are both saying the same things to the homeowners to have clarity for them that that is illegal in the state of Minnesota.
We like clarity. Thank you very much. Members, any questions on that? Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill does a lot of good things regarding property losses. A contractor offering to pay a homeowner's deductible is by statute considered fraud, which effective July 1 is now a felony. And this will ensure anyone who crosses the line from greed to fraud knowing that that's what they're doing. This also puts an onus on the claim adjuster and the contractor to notify not only on the form but on the spot on the form that the insurer is actually going to look at it, which is the final number of the bid, that it is against the law for the contractor to pay the deductible. It is against the law for the homeowner to coerce the contractor into paying the deductible. It violates the condition section of the policy. This is a really good bill.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Not seeing any other questions. Is there anybody else in the crowd that wants to speak on this bill? Not seeing anybody. Representative Howell will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's important to note that with that increase in penalty, we want to make sure everybody's noticed of what needs to happen. So appreciate support.
That sounds good. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2899, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. Those in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you both for testifying. You're on your way to the General Register. Next up, Representative Jessup.
Randy.
Representative Jessup, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 3224, and the motion is that it be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Jessup, to your bill. Oh, I apologize. There is a A1 amendment. I did not see that. I will also move the A1 amendment. Those in favor of the adoption of the A1, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Thank you, members. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Jessup, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair. Happy for the opportunity. I come before you really representing our credit unions in the state of Minnesota. And I have with me Ryan Smith. He is the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Credit Union Network, in case there are any questions. This bill before you is brought again by the credit unions with some revisions for their bylaws by how they are offered, as well as kind of how they are approved by their members. There is also some provisions for electronic communication of balloting. And the amendment that you just went ahead and approved as well is as a result of some input from the Department of Commerce. The key kind of section is that there is a Section 3, a repealer of some Minnesota rules already in place, and that will no longer continue as requested by the Department of Commerce. That's what we have before you.
Thank you, Representative Jessup. Mr. Smith, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think maybe what I'll just do is, as I was told once by the chair a long time ago, that brevity is a very valued commodity around here. And so what I will just say is that the bill before you just basically empowers the democratically elected board of directors to act more on behalf of credit unions, as well as giving a little bit more definition to cause in terms of terminating membership for various reasons. Pretty basic issues before you, but happy to answer any questions.
Members, what do you think? That wasn't the most brief brevity that I've ever heard. I don't know. Any questions for either of the testifiers?
Can you do it? Maybe
sure. Anybody else want to speak on the bill? Not seeing anybody. Representative Jessup, do you want a final word?
Thank you for your support.
That's brevity. We like that. I will renew my motion that House File 3224 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Thank you, members. The motion does prevail, and the bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, gentlemen. Next up, House File 3623, Representative Bliss. Representative Bliss, I think this is the first bill we've had up today that we don't have an author's amendment on. We'll come up with something. I will move House File 3623 so it is before the committee. Representative Bliss, to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My bill adjusts the compensation to lottery retailers in the state. It's been 21 years since they've had an adjustment. And I do have a testifier here that's probably going to talk about the overhead costs increasing over those 21 years and the impact it's had on her. So I'll pass it.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Representative Bliss. Go ahead, speak.
Chair Hoppe, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Jamie Poole, president of the Minnesota Grocers, and I'm here to speak in support of House File 3623. The MGA is a state trade association representing the retail food industry for over 120 years. We have 300 retail, wholesale, and manufacturing members with nearly 1,100 stores statewide. Our member companies employ 125,000 union and non-union Minnesotans, about one out of every 20 jobs in the state. In our role, we feel it's critical to have strong relationships with the agencies that regulate our industry. The state lottery is one of those agencies. Our partnership with them is unique, as they are vendors as much as a state agency. We sell their products, provide labor, record keeping, and display space, all very similar to the other products we stock on our shelves. The state lottery, in turn, provides marketing tools to attract customers into our store to purchase their products. What makes this partnership so interesting is the fact that we do not have the ability to negotiate our compensation like we do with other vendors. Please consider that we are on track to process $6 billion worth of Minnesota State Lottery transactions over the next 10 years. It is critical that this relationship, like our other vendors, has each party working together to build successful outcomes. The lottery director has the ability to increase compensation for retailers through rulemaking. The Minnesota State Lottery currently provides a retail compensation rate of 5.5% on sales. This rate was last increased in 1998. A lot has changed for brick-and-mortar business since the last 20 years. One notable is that we have seen over an 80% increase in the state's minimum wage, and executing lottery sales certainly enlists our workforce. We have made repeated requests over the years for a review of our compensation rate, and we continually receive no response. House File 3623 asks the legislature to take action and presents an incremental increase in the retail lottery compensation rate. For example, if a retailer sells a dollar scratch-off ticket, which are a more labor-intensive product, they are able to keep three-fourths of a penny to help offset their costs. Additionally, the bill would increase the amount the retailer can retain for cashing a winning ticket from 1% to 2%. This means a retailer cashes a $1 winning ticket, they keep 2 cents instead of one. While these numbers might seem inconsequential, we are an industry that operates on pennies. Typically, our members' net profit margin is around 1%. Increasing the lottery reimbursement rate for the first time in 20 years supports growth in Main Street, Minnesota, by providing a reinvestment in the grocery and convenience stores of this state. We thank Representative Bliss for his leadership on this issue. Thank committee members for their time today, and I'm always happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Wool. Mr. Tolman next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Kevin Toma, and I work for the members of the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. We're the licensed petroleum dealers in Minnesota. We have memberships that include everybody from mom and pop convenience stores all the way to the large chains. 5.5 to 6.2% on sales, we believe, is a good idea. When you take a look at all the new payment systems that are coming into play, Android Pay, Apple Pay, debit cards are the preferred method of payment for most young people nowadays. Those types of payments come at a cost to retailers anywhere between 2.5% to 3%. So when you look at it, our payment isn't actually 5.5%. It's more in the 2.5 to 3% range, considering the new methods of payments. We believe that the 1% changing to 2% on the redemption rate is also a great idea. We support that. When you look at an SBA loan, currently the rate is 6.25%, and actually what we're doing is loaning the state money to pay these winners. So we thank the author and are supportive of 3623. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Toma. Representative Davids first, and then Hillstrom.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. To Mr. Toma, this bill in no way allows lottery to pump, does it?
Mr. Toma.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, no, it does not.
Okay. For the record, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
For the records, Mr. Toma, good call. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's my understanding the department is also looking at a proposal to change the amount of reimbursement, but only for people who are in compliance with their contracts. Do you believe that everyone should get this raise, even if they are out of compliance with their contracts?
Ooh, good question.
Who wants to take that one?
I can take a shot at it. And you know, that it's funny that 21 years of multiple requests, they've not had any feedback to the retailers. And now that we've put this bill up, they're here to testify on, against it, and they'll do that. You know, I think that the retailers should comply with the rules, this should go to everybody that sells the ticket. It's overhead for them, and maybe they're not complying to the rules because the compensation isn't high enough, and they're not able to hire the right people. Do you want to?
Anybody else wants to add? Feel free, Ms. Fool.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that is in the proposal is that it's a star. We've discussed it with them. It's a star retailer, and it isn't about complying with the contract. It's about making sure that they're hitting certain benchmarks and certain caveats within that, because if a retailer isn't complying with the contract, they would pull that support. So I think they already are in compliance, and this just creates some things that the star retailer would have to do that's different than all retailers. So there's probably 80% of the folks, maybe 90% meet. We don't know those numbers yet. We're waiting to hear back from the lottery. So,
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would you be open to an amendment? I didn't draft anything today, but as this bill moves on, would you be open to an amendment to say that the person is only entitled to additional dollars if they're in compliance with the contract? It's my understanding that there have been a large amount of money spent over time in getting folks to be compliant. So my legislative district has high poverty, but we are also big-time users of these state amenities, if you call them that. But not everyone follows the rules. And the department has to spend a lot of money to sometimes collect the money that they need to collect that we charge them with under the statute. So my question would be, would you consider it a friendly amendment as this proposal moves forward to incentivize only those that are following the rules and disincentivize those who are not?
We could talk about it. I don't think I would do it right here. My concern is if the department knows of vendors that aren't complying to the rules, there should be penalties already in place. I'd be willing to talk to you, but I'm not really open to it right now.
So we're getting dangerously close into the state government finance here. Hang on. Wait, that's where we're sending the bill. We can talk about it there.
There you go.
Fun. I will Representative Hillstrom. You bring up and issues that he can solve on other committees.
Actually, if I
that's
could,
your gift.
If I could step in, I know that the folks from the lottery are here, and we've already they're working with the retailers right now, so that might be something they can address as an amendment.
Yep, we're going to have them come up and speak next, yes. And we do like authors and interested parties that are working together, as everybody knows. So, with that, Representative Hillstrom, another question, or should we get the folks from the lottery coming on now?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to know if he wants to give everybody a raise or only the good actors a raise, Mr. Chair.
Excellent question. Maybe we'll get an answer from the lottery folks. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please identify yourselves for the tape and start whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, my name is Adam Prock. I'm the Director of Communications and Government Affairs for the Minnesota State Lottery. With me today is Ben Friedland, General Counsel for the Minnesota State Lottery. The lottery's new executive director, Robert Doty, is out of town on business. He regrets he's unable to be here, but he extends his regards and appreciates you allowing us to comment on the bill. The Minnesota Lottery respectfully opposes this legislation. However, let me be clear, we value our retail partners. They're essential to the lottery's ongoing success. When our retailers win, the lottery and Minnesota wins. The lottery is constitutionally mandated mission is simple: raise funds to support efforts in Minnesota that benefit all of us. To that end, it is important to highlight that if House File 3623 were implemented as written, it would result in a decrease of nearly $60 million for the state over the next 10 years, including approximately $24 million less for the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. House File 3623 increases the commission on all scratch ticket sales without regard to whether a retailer is complying with their contractual obligations or working to increase ticket sales. Based on lottery experience and industry consensus, we do not believe legislating an across-the-board commission increase would be good for our retail partners or the state of Minnesota. The Minnesota Lottery's commission rate is in line with the lottery industry. Our rate ranks in the top half of state lotteries around the country. The Minnesota Lottery works collaboratively with all of our retail partners to ensure steady sales growth. Our efforts have resulted in significant year-over-year increases in commission payments. The fact is, the average retail commissions have increased by 53% over the last 8 years. Further, the Minnesota State Lottery operates a different retail arrangement than nearly all other lotteries. In Minnesota, lottery tickets are sold on consignment. The state provides millions of dollars in tickets to its retailers and does not collect any proceeds until those tickets are sold. In other states, the retailer assumes the risk of unsold tickets and must provide upfront money for sales. None of this is intended to say that increases in retailer commissions should not be considered. In fact, this is an important conversation that the Minnesota Lottery and its great retailer partners have already begun to have. Director Doty and lottery staff have spent the last several months reviewing our retail partnerships, including commission rates and best practices. We have talked with other states to learn how we can leverage their success to drive results. As a result of our review, we've determined an incentive-based program that raises commissions for retailers in good standing while providing incentives for those who maximize sales would have the most upside for both the retailers and the state. Rather than an across-the-board increase mandated by House File 3623, our plan is to implement the new Star Retail Program on July 1, 2018, something that can be done without a change to law. The program has two parts. First, it increases commissions on scratch tickets from 5.5% to 6%, and in order to qualify for the increase, retailers must follow very basic rules, most of which are already required under their current contracts. The vast majority of retail partners would easily meet these requirements and qualify for the increase. The second, the Star Retailer Program incentivizes retailers to increase returns by doubling the commission rate to 12% on any sales that exceed their previous fiscal year. We believe creating this industry-leading bonus commission program will benefit retailers and the state. We have discussed the details of our Star Retailer Program with representatives of our retailer partners. However, they maintain that legislatively mandated across-the-board increases is their preferred path for commission change. We respectfully disagree. Current law already requires the director of the Minnesota Lottery to review commission rates and make adjustments.
This existing authority is the most appropriate means to address commission change. Our goal is to create a program that benefits both retailers and the state. We respectfully oppose this legislation because an across-the-board increase in commissions will not help the lottery meet its constitutionally mandated objectives. Rather, we believe the Star Retailer Program will create a win-win. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Prock. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me how much approximately you spend getting people to comply with the rules?
Mr. Prock or Mr. Friedland?
Mr. Chairman, member, we have a full-time staff member that does probably 95% of her work on chasing these sorts of accounts. We also have a contract with the Department of Revenue to do some collections work, and we write off uncollectible accounts every single year, tens of thousands of dollars.
And Mr. Friedland, could you identify yourself for the tape?
Sure, Glenn Friedland, General Counsel for the Minnesota Water.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you don't have to give it to me today, but if we could get a list of the write-off numbers, some
sure.
summaries over the last couple years so that we get a sense of how many folks and how much you collect through your collections efforts, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, you mentioned states being consignment states versus upfront. Is Wisconsin a consignment state or an upfront state? Do you happen to know the answer to that?
They're an upfront state. That's why when you're oftentimes traveling in Wisconsin, you'll see tickets with Christmas trees on them in July because they've invested in those tickets and they have to stay there until they're sold.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, we have information from the proponents of the bill, just comparing Minnesota's rate of 5.5% to 6.25% for Wisconsin, but it does sound like from what you're saying that is a difference between the states. As in Minnesota, more of the risk is on the state, or less of the risk is on the retailer versus in Wisconsin. Am I describing that correctly?
That is correct.
Okay. And then maybe this is a question to the bill's author, but I'm wondering, is there the equivalent of like a fiscal note? Is there a fiscal note or the equivalent of it for this? Just because I gather the claim by the opponents is that this will have a $60 million impact. I'm not sure if that's just the general fund or to other, but so just to represent Bliss on that.
Yeah. Representative Pinto, we are sending this to State Gov Finance, and we are fortunate enough to have Representative Anderson here, otherwise known as Chair Anderson of the State Gov Finance Committee. So she wants to weigh in on that. You're certainly welcome to.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think I'm destroying the microphone here. Representative Pinto, that's part of the purview of State Government Finance, and we will be having that conversation. Thanks for your interest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess that'll be, I guess I'll be interested to follow that. I'm not on that committee, but I'll be interested to follow that, because I do, that's obviously a pretty significant amount of money, not going to the general fund, not going to these good causes, and so, but I know that'll be examined quite closely in Chair Anderson's committee. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Good question. Other questions, members? Is there anyone else who wants to represent Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So could you lay out the difference? Do you know the financial difference between the plan you're getting ready to implement versus the proposal in the bill and what impact that might be?
Mr. Friedland?
Chair, Representative, it's difficult to tell because the proposed bill is an across-the-board increase, and lottery industry experts, including at State Lottery, believe that that will have no impact on sales. However, the Star Retailer Program, which we've proposed, will dramatically incentivize retailers to work hard to ask for the sale to give us better and more prominent space. So we believe that that will drive sales and increase sales, which will increase profits. That said, we can develop that sort of fiscal note, and we can give you a good faith estimate, but we anticipate that it will drive profits, which is different than the proposed legislation.
Thank you. Is there anybody else that wants to speak on the bill for or against? Seeing none, Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to point out, I'm a little bit appalled because from what I've heard in the testimony today, I hear that there is an enforcement problem. And it sounds like we would be punishing the good actors instead of the bad actors. So I wanted that to be on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. With that, Representative Bliss, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, that just this, the rates haven't been increased in 20 years. I think it's very important to the lottery retailers out there that we increase the baseline.
As has been stated in testimony, the overhead is increased by 80% on the minimum wage, insurance, electricity, everything's going up, so I think it's time we just increase the base, and I thank you for your support.
Thank you, Representative Bliss, and with that I will renew my motion that House File 3623 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Bliss, you're on your way. Thank you, gentlemen. Next up, House File 3284, Representative West. And while Representative West is making his way up, I don't know that I've ever done this before. I don't know that I've ever heard a chair do this before, but I'm going to move the minutes from our last meeting.
Wow.
Clear breach of legislative protocol. Anybody have any comments, questions, concerns, corrections, objections? Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Thank you. With that, our minutes are approved. And Representative O'Driscoll, would you like to move House File 3623?
What number, Mr. Chair?
Wait, that's not the right number. 3284. I'm sorry, House File 3284, and that is going to HHS reform.
Mr. Chair, I'm with House File 3284 to be referred to the committee on. That's how long my memory is right now.
HHS reform.
HHS reform.
We're almost to pass over Easter break, Representative O'Driscoll. With that, Representative West, welcome to the committee. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you'll see I did the customary treats for the esteemed members of the committee. This is my first time before you. And Representative Nash isn't here, but I brought him some bananas. Oh, there he is. Well, you got some bananas on the other side.
Very nice.
House File 3284 allows modular homes to be placed in manufactured housing parks unless there is a local ordinance to the contrary. Current law does not allow this, and this would give manufactured housing parks a lot more flexibility in what they can put in their parks and give consumers more choice. Also brought a handout here, if the page can come by and grab that briefly, which shows you what we're talking about. Modular homes are basically homes manufactured in a enclosed space, and then they're put together on site piece by piece. And I have Mr. Brunner here from the Manufactured Housing Association to provide any more additional details.
Mr. Brunner, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Brunner. I'm with the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. We represent the builders of manufactured and modular homes. There are a total of about 16 license plants in the state that build modular homes. Many of them are smaller, and there are another four that are part of that group that also build manufactured homes, and we represent about 80-85% of the production of those plants. We also represent the manufactured home park community owners, and that's really what this bill is all about. Essentially, manufactured home parks in the state are the largest source of non-subsidized affordable housing. And back in the 1950s, the statute was drafted requiring licensure, and it specifically allows that manufactured homes can be placed in a manufactured home park community. At that time, modular homes didn't exist. And the handout that I brought with me gives you an idea as to why we now want to allow modular homes to be placed in a manufactured home park. Manufactured homes are built to a federal building code. You don't have as much flexibility in designs. The code is enforced by the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, and it's a manufactured homes are a part of the state building code. Modular homes, on the other hand, are built to the state building code or the IRC. They receive a label, and oftentimes they're built in the same plant as a manufactured home. However, a modular home, you have more flexibility. You can build smaller homes, more unique designs, as you can see on some of the photos. And the idea is, with the bill, is to simply allow a modular home, which are virtually indistinguishable in many cases from a manufactured home, to be placed in a manufactured home park. There are about 900 manufactured home parks in the state. We've heard from our members, and others that there are some opportunities to bring in these smaller homes. There seems to be an initiative or effort for millennials and even retiring boomers looking for a smaller footprint in a home, and we feel that we can provide that opportunity in a manufactured home park community. There are nearly 50,000 home sites in the state, so just as a way to preserve that source of non-subsidized affordable housing, the bill would allow this. We worked with the Department of Labor and Industry on the language that got us to where we're at, and we'd appreciate the support.
That sounds good, Mr. Bruner. Members, any questions? Not seeing any. Is there anybody else that wants to speak on the bill? Not seeing any there either. Representative West will give you the final word.
Thank you, member.
West, we like that. That's a good final word. With that, Representative Woodruff will read the motion that House File 3284 be re-referred to the Committee on HHS Reform. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, gentlemen. Don't move. House File 3285. And we have the A180708 amendment. Representative Crescia, do you want to move this bill for Representative West and the 0708 bill. Amendment?
I will move the bill.
Thank you, Representative West. To your bill. The author's amendment that I already mentioned, we should vote on that adoption before we talk about it.
I move the amendment too.
Those in favor of the adoption of the A180708 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative West, thank you for your indulgence. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is a priority for my community and the manufacturing community as a whole, and it's also included in the, a similar version is included in the Governor Dayton's budget. The most important thing it does is increase the trust fund cap from $1 to $3 million. That trust fund is used for relocation of manufactured home parks that are closed and have to relocate. Right now, that trust gets drawn down basically to zero every year, and this will allow it to refill to a higher number of $3 million, and that should suffice at least for the foreseeable future. It also requires an appointment of a qualified third-party neutral administrator for the fund. Currently, there are no qualifications for that position, and it'd be good if that person had familiarity with manufactured housing community. It also requires that the Department of Health maintain a master list of all parks in the state. Currently, there is no master list, or not one that can be communicated between departments, and we want to ensure that the fee for this trust fund can be acquired from the beneficiaries. And the author's amendment brought this bill more in line with exactly what the governor is proposing. There's still some differences, and I've talked with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and they are happy that this amendment brings it closer, and we'll continue to work with them to bring forward. But as of now, they're not actively opposing this bill, to my knowledge. And I have Bill Brunner here for round two.
Thank you. You guys are working well together. Thank you, Representative West. Mr. Bruner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Essentially, the bill cleans up a statute that was enacted in 2007. It was a bipartisan sort of effort or initiative when we first saw some older manufactured home parks that were closed as a way to provide some relocation assistance for those that are having to relocate for whatever reason their property closed. I mean, it's not often that these manufactured home communities close, but for whatever reason it happens occasionally. The fund has been operational now for nearly 11 years. There have been some changes in the fund over the course of that time. Initially, it was set up as sort of an insurance policy. In other words, if you paid into the fund annually a $12 fee, and if your manufactured home park were to close, you'd be covered. You'd receive some relocation assistance to find another location, or if you couldn't move your home for whatever reason, the fund would purchase your home for a certain amount that was capped. And then I think it was about 2009. It wasn't with agreement from the industry that this happened, but the insurance fund concept went away, and it was changed so that the owner of the manufactured home park now receives one invoice and they are responsible for paying for each one of their residents, and they in turn could collect the, it's now $15 from each of their residents or the homeowners. And if the homeowner chooses not to pay the renter, the only recourse that the manufactured home park owner has is to file eviction charges over the $15 for somebody who's probably paying, you know, $300-$400 a month in rent. If the economics just don't work there. However, so that's the system that's in place. The fund essentially blinks off. In other words, so there's this invoicing or collection. If the fund balance drops below $1 million, then there's no collection on the fund. There hadn't been a collection, I think, in about 5 years. This past year was the first time there was a collection. It didn't go very well. There had been some changes in staff at the MMB. The two older manufactured home parks had closed, and so the fund was drained down to a pretty low balance. So what the bill does is, as Representative West pointed out, increases this cap on the fund from $1 million to $3 million. It also clarifies that the person, a municipality is required to appoint what's called this third-party neutral that sort of handles the transaction, the closing, makes the payments at the local level. It adds some language to the statute. It says the lease have to be qualified in some way, and then it does give some specifics in terms of the qualifications. Some additional language here adds some financial accountability so that this third party that's doing the writing the checks and collecting money actually has to provide a little more documentation to the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. They in turn are responsible for submitting a report annually to the Senate Finance Committee Chair and House Ways and Means Committee in terms of the balance of the fund and reporting on how money is being spent. What the bill does is now requires the department or the agency to post this information on their website in October of each year. Right now, we have to wait until the reports actually make their way through the legislative reference library and appear on their website. So this would just be a little more direct approach. It also adds some language that in the case of a resident who's receiving some relocation benefits, that those benefits have to be paid to them by the neutral third party within 14 days. So if they need to be paid so their home can be relocated, there's at least a 14-day window in place right now. There is no requirement in terms of how quickly that needs to be paid. Makes a couple other changes. The current relocation distance for a home is 25 miles. It increases that out to 50 miles for someone qualifying for for relocation benefits. We have worked with the advocate groups on the language, as well as the Housing Finance Agency, and have accommodated some of the concerns and issues that they raised in the amendment. But we think that the bill will go a long way in terms of strengthening the fund. The final thing that it does is creates a mechanism now so that the MMB, which is responsible for now invoicing the owners of manufactured home parks based on a list that they receive, or that they were to compile, that didn't really necessarily have to come from any particular location, and it was getting them a return rate of, they mailed 900 invoices, I think they received back about 300. It wasn't a good list. Well, what the additional language does now is require that the Department of Health, which licenses manufactured home parks, along with about 60 local departments that do inspection through delegation agreements, report annually to MMB the lists of those entities that they license, so that MMB has a more comprehensive list and they can send out a complete invoicing to everyone that's required to pay. That's just a quick summary of what the bill does.
Quick?
Thank you, Mr. Berner. Members, any questions? Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, have you talked to, like, Legal Aid to make sure that they believe that the new language, like, for example, online 2.30 to 2.33, that they believe that this stuff is offers enough protection?
Representative Hillstrom, I've talked to Legal Aid a number of times, not about this, and I think he would have brought it up, but have you, Representative West or Mr. Berner, have you talked to Mr. Elwood?
I have, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Berner.
I have not heard from Ron Elwood on the bill. We have talked to the advocates, the All Parks Alliance for Change, but we've not heard from Legal Aid.
I'll ask him. I'll see him. I don't know if it will still be today, but I'll see him in the next couple of days and ask. That's a good point. Representative Hillstrom. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Berner, I'm looking at the A18 amendment, and can you just help me out on the $400,000 that you're asking MMB to advance? Where would that come from? Is it just the general fund bottom line? Where would those funds come from if there was a situation where you guys fell short?
Mr. Berner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the intent there is that if there is the shortfall, that the Commissioner of MMB and Housing Finance Agency make a determination as to where that would come from. It doesn't specifically direct them to go to a fund of money, and then this would be reimbursed to wherever the funds came from.
Representative Anderson.
And Mr. Chair, is there anyone from MMB here that could maybe speak to that at all? I'm just curious as to where they would pick the funds from. And how they would allocate them.
I don't know about that. I know we have Ms. Topinka from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency who might be able to answer that. If not, we can get that answer. Ms. Topinka, welcome to the committee.
Hi, I'm Katie Topinka, the Legislative Director at Minnesota Housing. This provision was in the original bill when the Relocation Trust Fund passed. I'm not sure that it was ever used. But in discussing this, the Minnesota Housing does have some funds within its agency that aren't general funds, but because we're much like a bank, we have some funds available that we may be able to sort of lend to the program until we can be reimbursed. So that is one possibility. It is capped at the $400,000 because that's about how much is collected in assessments each year.
Thank you, Mr. Pinker. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative West, I'd like to work with you on this piece because I think it would be helpful to spell that out in the bill as where the funds are going to come from, that it's going to come from the Housing Finance Agency's pot. I think that just would give me greater comfort.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Pinker. Do you have other things? Did you have other things that you want to say towards the bill? And Mr. Berner and Representative West, this is why we never mention Mr. Elwood's name out loud, because you were talking about him and he walks into the room. It's uncanny. Happens all the time. Mr. Pinker, are there other comments you wanted to make?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, just wanted to reiterate, as Representative West said, the governor in his supplemental budget proposal did include the provision to raise the cap of the Relocation Trust Fund from $1 million to $3 million. We did see last year with a couple of large park closings, the fund did almost get to a balance of zero, and so we are concerned that if that were to happen again, we may not be able to pay the relocation expenses for homeowners. And so we think raising it to that $3 million level is a good idea. As Representative West stated, there are a few differences still between what the governor is proposing and this bill. So we would like to continue talking and see if we can get to a place where we're all supportive of the proposal.
Thank you very much. We always like hearing that. And Mr. Berner, Representative West, nice work on this. And it's nice that you're continuing to work and then have Representative Anderson help as well. Representative Hillstrom. Mr. Elwood came in. Do you want to have him come down and ask him a quick question, or do we want to talk to him offline afterwards? Mr. Elwood, do you want to say anything about this, the bill run? For the tape, we have a vigorous head shaking there. So with that, not seeing any other questions. We know Mr. Elwood doesn't want to speak. Does anyone else want to speak on this bill? Not seeing anyone. Representative West, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's good. Thank you, Representative West and Mr. Bruder. And with that, Representative Creature renews his motion that House File 3285, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on HHS Reform. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Gentlemen, thank you. And you've got one more. You guys are good. House File 3807. Who wants to move a bill? Representative Swedzinski or Representative Nash?
I'll move 3807 to...
I'm sorry. The motion is to go to Jobs and Energy. Representative Nash moves House File 3807 to, and the referral is to Jobs and Energy. Representative West, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3807 cuts the licensing fee for manufactured home installers from $300 to $180. It also removes, removes language stating that the licensure is manufactured home installer is a business license for the purpose of calculating fees. This was looked at last year, well, it actually was overlooked last year by the Department of Labor and Industry, and they merely forgot to include it in the licensure bill they brought last year, and this will bring it in line with the rest of the licenses. And Bill Brenner probably has one last thing to say for round three.
And then
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mark Brunner. As Representative West said, this bill is sort of a carryover from last session to lower the fee for installers. Because of the uptick in permit income for the Department of Labor and Industry, their bill last year actually lowered fees for contractors. However, we discovered in statute at that time there were two provisions putting a fee on manufactured home installers. One was a higher fee, one was a lower fee, and because of the timing of the session last year, we just decided to pull that out, take a look at it for this year, work with the department on the current bill, and they are not opposed to this. It essentially lowers the fee from $300, which is a three-year license, to $180, and manufactured home installers are required under federal law to install initially a new manufactured home. However, they're licensed by the Department of Labor and Industry, and it all has to do with them being required to do the installation for warranty purposes and things like that. So this just brings us more in line with what happened last session to other contractors. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Members, any questions? Anybody else in the audience want to speak on this bill? With that, I see only one flaw in your ointment. You guys do good work together. The only problem is that only two of the three bills are going to the same next committee, so you're going to have to split up your act. And with that, Representative Nash renews his motion that House File 3807, as amended, be re-referred to Committee on Jobs and Energy. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Gentlemen, thank you. And with that, Representative Munson, House File 3396. Representative Swedzinski, do you want to move House File 3396?
Mr. Chair, I move House File 3396 for the committee.
Yep. Thank you. And with that, Representative Munson, you can go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As it is my first time presenting a bill in front of you, I brought treats as well.
Thank you very much.
Locally grown from his district.
Once in a while, you're granted the privilege of carrying a bill that you believe really strongly in, and this is a bill that I believe strongly in. It's one of the reasons why I got involved in politics, due to government overreach in health care. This bill has to do with price transparency at the doctor's office. My family has purchased private insurance for years, and due to Obamacare and MinSure, we were outpriced in the market. Last year, the premiums for our family of four were $24,600 a year with a $13,000 deductible. That was the bronze plan on MinSure. Going around to doctors without insurance and asking them what services cost, we received a lot of different responses. Well, you have insurance, don't you? Or they just don't know. Or you'll find out in a month, which is just an unacceptable answer to trying to find health care and shop around for a price that's decent that you want to purchase. So I was excited to carry this bill, which requires doctors to post their most the prices for the most frequent or their common services, the top 25 most frequently billed services in their clinic, and then in addition, the top 10 most frequent preventative care services. This will allow people to see the price of what things cost for cash, an average or the cost that the highest volume private insurance carrier reimburses at, and then the cost for Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement. So they can actually compare the prices and do some shopping to find the best value for their care. I have with me today a few testifiers. The first one is Mr. Dave Racer, and I hand it over to him.
Thank you.
Mr. Racer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The handouts
Yeah, do we have some handouts that are going around?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dave Racer.
Mr. Racer, can you move over in front of one of the microphones so the chair can pick it up?
Of course.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dave Racer. I live in St. Paul in House District 67A and came to speak in favor of House File 3396. Since 2005, I've co-authored, authored, edited, published 18 books on U.S. health care. In Minnesota, I provide legislative updates to about 2,000 health insurance agents and more than 100 physicians, and I'm a board member of the Minnesota Physician Patient Alliance. My most previous book is entitled Passion for Patients, and I believe that the mission of any health care or insurance reform should focus on the patient experience. This requires giving patients more information and providing incentives to reduce the price of care. One critical way in which our system is broken is that no one knows the price of care until weeks after they receive it. Unlike everything else we purchase with health care, the price is purposefully hidden from us. But we need to know it if we're going to make good decisions about our own care. The lack of price transparency hurts uninsured people the most. And I've included one example for you today in the tables. I realize I gave you a two-sided document. This, I'm just referring to the first side. I was told not to load you up with a lot of stuff, okay? When you go to your family practice doctor under your state employer plan, you don't ask about the price. And why don't you ask about the price? Well, because somebody else pays it, and as far as you know, your network negotiated a good discount off the inflated provider charge. And you can see in my example, and these are actual examples from a clinic in the western suburbs, the doctor paid billed $214 for a medium-length office exam. Your network pays the doctor $170, and it looks like a really good deal to you. But for the uninsured, it's the gotcha price. That's what that character means on the bottom, because they face a $214 charge. It's unfair that someone without insurance would have to pay so much more, and it's made worse because that uninsured person, like everyone else, is denied the right to see the price up front. Now, note on the chart that the government appears to get a good deal. Medicare only pays $107.20, and medical assistance, or Minnesota Care, pays $83.20. Those are rates right off the state's rate sheets, by the way. But know this, the doctor cannot afford to stay in practice at these rates. The $170 you pay and the $214 paid by the uninsured person includes cost shifting to cover those losses. This is a hidden tax on people with private insurance, especially with high deductibles. It works a high tax, a hidden tax on the uninsured. Commercial insurance premiums are soaring. Tens of thousands, you just heard a case here, dropped their coverage. The legislature spent hundreds of millions of dollars last session buying down those premiums in the individual market. And a good deal of that money goes to cover cost shifting from Minnesota Care, from medical assistance. And yet nobody knows the price of care. They don't get to know it because payers don't want them to know it. Especially important is the provision, I think, of this bill prohibiting the payers from preventing disclosure of the corrected price or contracted price of care and the good faith estimates when asked to disclose the prices. This bill begins to unwind the gag order on price disclosure. We're asking, just tell us the price of care. That's all we want to know. Tell us the price of our care.
Thank you, Mr. Racer.
Carl.
Okay.
Mr. Shaw, I assume? Mr. Brooklyn?
Yes.
Please proceed with your, when you're ready.
I am Colley Brooklyn, MD, a retired family physician from New Prague, Minnesota. Mr. Chair and members of the Commerce Committee, I appreciate having the opportunity to testify before you today on the importance of medical price transparency in controlling spiraling health care costs. The late Uri Reinhart was famous for answering the question about what drives high U.S. health care costs with the assertion, "It's the prices, stupid." He died in November 2017. He was widely recognized as one of the leading authorities in healthcare economics for more than four decades. Reinhart strongly emphasized the importance of healthcare price transparency and suggested an important factor facilitating high U.S. prices for healthcare was the shroud of secrecy draped over the healthcare prices negotiated in the private sector. Those prices were kept as trade secrets. Where were physicians, hospitals, imaging centers, or other clinicians or healthcare centers who posted on their websites the prices for frequently performed procedures? Furthermore, few healthcare practitioners or centers were willing to quote prices over the phone for even standard procedures such as a normal vaginal delivery. The implication of Reinhart's remarks were that if individuals knew more about the costs of their health care services, they and their physicians would make better decisions. Reinhart pointed out that there was price transparency in virtually every segment of the U.S. economy except health care. He would raise the question, why are prices hidden from patients? Perhaps it's not possible to determine the true prices of the true cost of prices. Or perhaps healthcare organizations are reluctant or possibly embarrassed to reveal the actual costs and price variability to patients, such as the wide variability of prices from hospital to hospital. For instance, how can a C-section, say, cost $1,100 in one hospital and $2,500 in a hospital across the street? The care might be better, but not $1,400 better. Why does the same device or drug cost two or three or even 10 times more in the U.S. than in Europe? Now to my remarks, which I feel represent my patients' feelings on this issue. To bring down intractable rising health care costs, we have been told for years by employers and health insurance companies to be wise health care consumers. How can we be wise healthcare consumers if we don't know the actual prices of healthcare services, products, and procedures? We can't. Pricing in healthcare in most cases has been really secretive. Patients haven't had the knowledge up front about what things actually cost until after the bills arrive weeks or months later. How can you have a media touted, patient-centered, patient-controlled, patient-driven healthcare system without patients knowing prices? You can't. Unlike in retail and healthcare, bigger is not cheaper. Unlike in retail and healthcare, there is no competition based on price because we don't know the price. The first step in reducing costs is knowing the costs. Right now, what determines price is whatever they say. Consumers are accustomed to retail-level transparency of pricing. This retail-level of price clarity is now becoming even more important because consumers are paying an increasing larger share of their health care costs. The present policy formulated by the present players on containment of health care costs has failed. We need a new player, the patient, the consumer of health care. Again, without empowering the patient by him or her knowing prices, health care costs will continue to increase uncontrollably because of the patient's lack of choice in cost reduction strategies. Thank you for allowing me to give this testimony.
Thank you, Dr. Berkland. Members, questions? Mr. Racer, did you have a...
Excuse me, sir, I'm not a member. Dr. Shaw is here, I guess.
Oh, no, I saw that. Okay. Come on down, Dr. Shaw.
Sorry.
Dr. Shaw, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed whenever you're ready.
My name is Neil A. Shaw. Thank you for having me. Just got here in time. So thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HF 3396. Briefly, I'm a board-certified dermatologist, an alumnus of the University of Minnesota, and trained at the Mayo Clinic. And I'm in private practice in St. Anthony, Minnesota. I'm also a small business owner and father of three kids. And as you all know, healthcare costs have grown at a staggering pace over the last few decades. The reasons are myriad, but there's no doubt that we pay a lot more now than we used to. For my family of five, we pay $14,000 a year for health insurance coverage for a $6,000 individual deductible and a $13,000 family deductible. Those are staggering costs, and I don't think that I'm alone. We're essentially cash payers with our healthcare dollars until we hit our deductible. Not even delivering a child will actually get us to our deductible. So many Minnesotans, particularly those employed by small businesses or that are self-employed, are similarly situated. In fact, the average American deductible, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, is increased from roughly $600 a decade ago to $1,300, and that's nationwide. It's a staggering increase with that wages have not kept up with. We're purchasing nearly all other goods and services. Consumers have transparent pricing information clearly disclosed. I don't learn the price of milk after my family drinks that milk after I've brought it home. It is clearly displayed to me at the store before I make a purchase. And you may choose to buy more expensive milk, but the price is disclosed to you, and the price is one component of a reasonable decision-making process that now is obscured to us in healthcare. Price transparency is critical and fundamental to the efficient function of all markets, and healthcare is no different. Unfortunately, that clarity of pricing does not extend most healthcare purchases. The physician may be quote-unquote in-network with my insurance plan, but the specific clinic or hospital may have wildly differing rates for the exact same service provided compared to other in-network physicians. Recent data from the Minnesota Community Measurement data set reveals that pricing for identical procedures such as knee replacement or an uncomplicated delivery can vary up to 500% between the lowest and highest cost providers. In that specific data set, who those people are is actually statutorily blocked. So we know the variability, but we don't know who the highest is and who the lowest is. HF 3396 is a solid first step towards empowering Minnesotans to be smart utilizers of their healthcare dollars. This bill will help lift the curtain on healthcare prices for the benefit of Minnesotans and businesses that are purchasing healthcare or medical services. Continued opacity in healthcare pricing will continue to hurt Minnesotans by increasing their total healthcare costs and preventing healthcare providers from competing based on price, as occurs in every other sector of the economy. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and if any of you have any questions, I'm happy to address them either here or after this hearing.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw. Members, any questions for any of the testifiers? Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to thank Representative Munson for bringing this bill forward. We've been working for years on price transparency, and nibbling away at it is a good thing. Some of the things that need to be brought out to the open, as the testifiers mentioned, is the cost shifting, the in-network, out-of-network environment. You have health carriers that have an incredible amount of control over where you go, and I will call it steering, even though statutorily that's illegal. That's what's going on in the in-network, to the point where if you go to a medical provider who is an independent or is out-of-network provider, either none of those costs count towards your out-of-pocket, or only a portion of those costs count towards your out-of-pocket, even though you're paying it. That being said, even through all of that, you have people, especially in the outstate area, that would like to make an informed decision when they are purchasing health care, just like purchasing everything else. That's why I think this is just a great bill. Now, we've already got provisions in statute that if you request from the provider what the costs are going to be, they have to tell you. This just takes it the next step so that you can shop.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Is there anybody else in the crowd that wants to speak on this bill, for or against? Members, any questions? And I think, gentlemen, when we're looking at this issue, whether we're looking at cost sharing in network, out of network. One of our problems is, as a state and as a society, we don't use health insurance as insurance. We just use it as a means of paying for health care. And I think you're trying to get at the fundamental, I mean, that's the fundamental problem. We need to solve that. And I appreciate the work on it. And Representative Munson will give you the final word.
I look forward to your support on the bill. I mean, the cost of health care, especially with Medicaid, is skyrocketing. We need to do everything we can to drive prices down, increase the level of service, and this is a large step forward towards that. So thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we do have another bill right after that's after this that's of a similar nature. We're going to lay this bill over, and we're going to go to Representative Anderson's bill, which is 3893. Representative Anderson will move her bill, House File 3893, and the motion is to send it to HHS reform. And Representative Anderson, you want to move the A1 amendment as well?
Yes, please.
Those in favor of the adoption of the A1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted. Thank you, members.
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Anderson, do you want to do the A3 amendment right now, or do you want to speak to the bill first? Whatever your preference.
Right now, please.
Then Representative Anderson will move the A3 amendment. Those in favor of its adoption signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Anderson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be brief. In the spirit of the Commerce Committee, this has been an issue that has been discussed with multiple individuals that have interest on this area. It continues to be a work in progress, and I welcome any feedback that the members have for me today moving forward. But in essence, what this bill does is gives greater transparency in pricing for consumers when they are making purchases on their health care. We do that in two different ways in this bill. One, we expand what the current law is. The current law requires that health providers provide this data, but there is no time frame for it. So what this bill does says that the healthcare provider needs to provide within 10 days data that the consumer then can use to make healthcare purchases and makes them a smarter consumer overall. In addition to that, it also requires that the healthcare provider provide details on the facility fees and any other fees that might be part of that medical treatment. Again, just another tool for consumers to use when they're making major purchases such as their healthcare. Makes them smarter and is just an overall good bill. And because we're doing it this way, we're also making sure that we're giving a more personalized consumer cost to individuals. And with that, Mr. Chair, I just ask for your support and thanks for your time.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Members, any other questions? Any questions? We have a number of other testifiers that want to come down. I don't know who wants to go first. Mr. Graves, since you're standing, do you want to come on down? Mr. Graves, welcome back to the committee.
Hey, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank Representative Anderson for bringing this bill forward. As you heard some of the discussion earlier, plan design has moved toward higher and higher deductibles and higher out-of-pocket costs for individuals. And that's largely a tool to try and help contain health care costs generally. But where that leaves us in Minnesota is with health plan design that has higher number of deductibles in plan design out there in our market, and those deductibles themselves are higher than they are in most other states. And so we appreciate Representative Anderson bringing this bill forward to help give consumers more tools at their disposal to shop and to plan for the care that they and their family need, and give insurance employers working with their employees have the tools that they need to be informed consumers. So I know there's others that want to speak, and I will leave it at that, but I, again, appreciate Representative Anderson bringing this forward and happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. Ms. Krinke, come on down. Ms. Krinke, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Poppy.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. First, I want to thank Representative Munson. I did have an opportunity to visit with Representative Munson yesterday, and I just have a couple comments regarding the A3 amendment. Just to let the committee know, we had signed off on Representative Anderson's original bill. We do still have some concerns with the A3 amendment, but do appreciate Representative Munson. He's made some changes on our behalf and look forward to continuing to work on this bill as it goes through the legislative process. A couple of points that I'd like to make. First of all, Medicare and Medicaid patients really don't shop very much for services. So this represents an additional amount of work as providers. The requirement in this amendment would be providers would have to post the 25 most frequent procedures above $25 and then put this in a chart with their charge price, their average commercial price, their Medicaid price, and their Medicare price. And this is going to be posted in the office or in the clinic. Now, I don't know about you guys, but in our lunchroom at the Minnesota Hospital Association, we have about 25 different posters that are on the lunchroom wall, and we never pretty much look at those. I don't know about you all, but those posters really don't make an impact with consumers. So you're at the doctor's office for 15 minutes. You're not probably walking around looking at the posters in the doctor's office. We would really like this amendment better on line 118 if instead of saying, it was posted, and it says in there, and on the website, if that were an or. And that may seem odd, but it's a fair amount of work to get all the clinics to have these posters ready and then also to have to do it on a website. So just would like to point that out. The last point I really want to make is that the calls that we get regarding these good faith estimates, the consumers want to know what they have to pay. Okay, that's the calls that we're getting. What do I have to pay? So the provider has to ask them, well, what insurance do you have and where are you at on your co-pays and deductibles? And so if we really want to get a true price transparency for the consumer, we're really going to have this work done by their health insurance company and not by the provider. So I'm not trying to be overly say that we can't do some of this work, but we cannot provide them with the information that they are truly looking for. We do not know what other healthcare services they've had in the course of the year. We don't know where they are on their copay and deductible. So, quite frankly, this would be a stronger bill if this work was to be done by the health plans rather than by the providers. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. And Mr. Stein, do you want to come down? Mr. Stein, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Bob Stein. I represent Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. Essentially, we are a membership of agents and brokers for employee benefits and health insurance and carriers. A couple of different things. We've been a proponent for transparency for years. Without transparency of costs, it's impossible to know the right type of product to give to an employee and or an individual. Transparency creates consumerism. This type of a transparency program, the consumer would actually be able to go to different providers and shop for that same benefit structure, whether it be a knee surgery, whether it be even just a private exam. The third category is that HSAs. Minnesota has the highest HSA participant per capita than any other state in the union. So we're running with the highest deductibles, so we have a lot of out-of-pocket expenses. So if anybody is going to try transparency, Minnesota would be the perfect state to try this so that we can create this consumerism. And then also, this potentially creates a market competition situation. If everybody is transparent on their costs, even the other clinics will know what the other clinics are costs, and it will create a competition situation for the most constant services provided. So we're proponents of this at any level, even at the smallest level, just to get that step forward to transparency.
Thank you, Mr. Stein. Members, any questions for any of the testifiers? I love a committee with perfect knowledge. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak on the bill, for or against it? Sure. Come on back down. If you could identify yourself again.
Dr. Carl Berkman from New Prague.
Thank you.
Maybe I misunderstood what the hospital representative stated. She stated this will not make an impact on consumers. What is she talking about? Consumers are looking for this information. At the last caucus I was at, specifically, I was asked about this, and they said they would love that. So I would say that consumers are avid and wishful and hopeful that they can get this information so they have some control over their health care costs.
Thank you, Dr. Berkman. Representative Anderson will give you the final word.
Just ask for your support, Mr. Chair.
With that, Representative Anderson renews her motion that House File 3893, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on HHS Reform. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Anderson. And with that, Representative Smith. House File 1609, Representative Smith. Mr. Representative Smith moves House File 1609, so it's in front of the committee, and then the A18-0699, 0622 amendment, which is a delete-all. And we have an amendment to the amendment, the A18-0699 amendment, which is in the packets. So we're going to vote on the 0699 amendment. All those in favor of adoption signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The 0699 is adopted to the 0622, which is the delete all. Those in favor of its adoption signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Smith, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and thank you all for your patience for the highlight.
Representative Smith, my apologies, but I forgot one thing. The motion is to send this bill to the General Register. To your bill.
Mr.
I'm sorry, State Government Finance, I misread that.
Sorry, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, for the highlight of the Day in Commerce Committee in this very short 29-page bill. This does redefine and update the Notary Acts and also creates a remote notary option, and I have an expert testifier I'd like to speak, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Michelle Timmons, and I think most of you know me as the former revisor of statutes. I'm now retired, but decided in retirement for my volunteer work, I wanted to continue on as a uniform law commissioner. So with that hat on, I've been leading a group of about 30 people representing business interests, government interests, including the Department of Commerce and Secretary of State, national notary experts, and as well as input from companies that provide notary services, remote notary services. And we've been studying the revised uniform law on notarial acts, also known as RULONA. And we've also been studying whether or not to permit remote notarizations using technology in Minnesota, and if so, how. So after meeting for about 6 months and a lucky 13 times, we reached a consensus that what we would do is propose the RULONA with provisions to tailor it to Minnesota, and then propose language based on model language from the Mortgage Bankers Association that has a high standard and details how the remote notarization would be done. The reason ultimately the group decided to put the remote notarization provisions in are to provide greater access. With being able to use technology to get a signature notarized, it can provide convenience, access for people who are a long ways away, even overseas, deployed overseas, people with mobility problems, there's a lot of potential there. And then secondarily, the group felt that since there are five states that are doing remote notarizations, and with the full faith and credit that Minnesota has for notarial acts from other states, the reality is that somebody in Minnesota could get a signature notarized in Virginia right now, right today, because they've had that since 2011. So the group really felt, let's propose something that we think will do this right, and that's what we've tried to put together. So with that overview, I just want to hone in on a few enforcement-related provisions that relate to the jurisdiction and interest of this committee. Section 15 in the Delete Everything, which begins on page 8, really is the section that allows that remote notarization. It sets up a high standard that requires two forms of identity proofing. It requires the remote notary to keep an electronic journal, to keep an audio and video of that transaction, and to keep that for 10 years. The notary public who wishes to become a remote notary has to fill out a special application with the Office of the Secretary of State. And if everything isn't according to Hoyle, the Secretary of State's office can reject the application. And then the Commerce Department comes in this section in lines 10.18 to 10.19 by stating that the Commerce Department has the power to revoke a registration as a remote notary. There's also an enforcement provision in Subdivision 9 that provides wrongful possession of the hardware or software that is used for this remote notarization can be a criminal offense and set at the misdemeanor level, which is consistent with other notarial act criminal problems that have been set at misdemeanor level in 359.08 for many, many years. The other enforcement provision is Section 22, which is on page 22 of the Delete Everything, and that really outlines the enforcement powers primarily of the Commerce Department. It retains the administrative type of enforcement that the Commerce Department has had under Chapter 45 and Minnesota Statutes 359.12 for many years. But it uses the framework of the Uniform Act and spells out in greater detail the kinds of things that are enforcement issues in this particular area. And the group even went a little bit beyond the Uniform Act by adding a provision that says, well, if the underlying license, like an attorney's license or a real estate broker's license, if that is suspended or revoked, that can be considered as a reason for also revoking a notary commission. And so with that, I think that highlights the enforcement provisions in the bill, and I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Dimmons, and thank you. You were one of the first people in here today, so thank you for your patience. You've been here a while. Representative Bauer has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure that this is necessarily for this testifier, but did let our Representative Smith know. I had a couple of questions. I'm a little sensitive about data privacy and consumer protection, just having gone through the whole Equifax piece. So I'm just wondering if you could walk us through how a remote authentication, if you will, works from behind the scenes. In other words, I know that there's access to third-party data and where that's warehoused and how the consumer is protected.
Representative Smith or Ms. Timmons?
Mr. Chairman, I can and members, I can start with this. One thing that we did put in Section 15 is a sort of quasi-data practices provision. And what we did is we We thought about whether or not, and I must credit Bert Black with bringing this up, whether or not the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act really applies to the data that somebody gives to a notary when they're going to get their signature notarized. And ultimately, we decided the best practice there would be to say, no, it's people don't think of that as government data. It's not like going to apply for your driver's license or a human services benefit. But what we did is we crafted language that made it act as if it were private data, so that that data can only be given to the person who signed or their authorized representative or personal representative in the case of a deceased individual. And so we did try to really write in some data privacy provisions there. And then I think perhaps Michael Chodos from Notarize might be a good person to answer questions about the more technological related privacy provisions.
Representative Barr, does that answer your question, or is that something that you want to talk to?
I think I need to hold off for the next testifier.
That's what I was wondering. Other questions? If not, is there anybody else that wants to come down and speak on this bill? Representative Nash had a question. My apologies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. Representative Smith, if I heard correctly from Ms. Timmons, this is going to be stored as an image file online for 10 years, is that correct? Did I hear that correctly?
Ms. Timmons.
I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm not sure of the exact format, but yes, it will need to be retained in an electronic format for 10 years.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
So, if you're storing these and it's going to be something that you can quickly access, it would have to be stored as an image file. Image files can't be deduplicated online because they're each unique. Even though it's a roughly the same type of image, they are unique because there's different people getting them, different signatures. Mm-hmm. Photographic files are huge in storage, and for 10 years, that's going to create a large storage requirement. And I'm just wondering, where is it going to be stored? What's the fiscal implication of that? And even though we're not, I know this is moving on, but I'm just trying to figure out who's going to store that and who's going to pay for the storage, whether it's on premises or in the cloud. There's a lot of questions that I have that would be relative to that, because 10 years of data is a ton of data.
Does anyone want to take that, or Representative Nash, do you want to answer that in its next committee stop?
Yeah, we'll deal with Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
If they can't answer it, maybe in the time between now and when we citizens.gov, we can have that answered. But just know my concern is, from a cost perspective, it's going to be massive.
If you want to take a crack at it, sir, please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Michael Chodos. I am the general counsel of Notarize. Notarize is one of the many vendors that operate in this space and which have software as a service platforms that allow a notary to connect with an individual or business online to have documents notarized. Just to be clear, the bill is utterly technology and vendor neutral, but we do operate in this space, and so we're here to answer questions because we knew there would be some potential technical questions that might come up today. So if I may answer the representative's question about storage. So the bill specifically, the storage responsibility is primarily that of the notary. In other words, the notary stores existing journal and related information in the paper context, and for many years they've been storing similar information in the electronic context. And now with the advent of video, the notary will have responsibility for storing those video files as well. The bill specifically authorizes the notary to appoint a repository, usually a platform or other vendor, that has bulk storage deals with Amazon and other similar kinds of web storage entities for which data storage costs at bulk, as I imagine you've experienced, have been plummeting dramatically over the last 10 years. So we as a vendor store many, many, many gigabytes of data over time, but the compression technologies for video are such that these files are increasing, the cost of storing is increasingly becoming if I can mix metaphors, a decreasing issue in the overall cost of providing the service. And I know
thank you, sir. Representative Nash, you're good. Members, any other questions? Representative Barr.
I think this testifier can answer my question about consumer protection and the storage of the data in terms of making sure that there aren't data breaches. I mean, when I hear that we're taking a photo of somebody's license and then potentially matching that up with other credit data, and I did have the opportunity to speak to the testifier, and I think it would be helpful if you could explain that.
Yes, Mr. Chorus?
Yes. If we think about notarization broadly, notarization is a service that is provided to ensure the integrity of a transaction. The notarial record becomes a significant record that sort of exists over time and in many cases over many years, which can later be referred to if there is some dispute about the underlying transaction. So on the one hand, with the advent of electronic notarization, you get a richer record of what actually occurred during the notarial act. You get a richer record of the identity validation of the party who appears, a tamper-proof version of the document after the notarial act is complete, and a full audit trail that the person knew what they were signing when they opened and reviewed and signed the document. So there is an extensive record that we all consider to be important for enforcement purposes down the road, or in the event of any dispute. At the same time, we and other vendors in this space are subject to a host of existing data privacy and other cybersecurity requirements because all notarial transactions occur in the context of some underlying transaction. Many of the most common ones, like mortgage or other kinds of transactions, occur in the context of very extensive data privacy laws and cybersecurity laws that cover all financial transactions. So a notary who engages in any electronic notarial act must comply directly or through indirect application of those laws from the customers who deal with them, including banks and financial institutions, with Graham Leach Wiley and a host of other federal and state laws that govern that. So, for example, when a party has their identity verified on one of these websites, that is done by a third-party provider such as LexisNexis or Experian or others, and the notary does not have access to any of the data that is in all of those databases that that party has. The notary merely provides the seed data, name, date, name, birth date, address, last four of the social, and that third-party provider searches its records and provides input back to the notary without providing access to that data. So the body of data that a notary has is extremely limited, and it has to be maintained under the bank grade level of cybersecurity that governs those financial transactions. So on our platform, for example, all of the data that moves back and forth between the notary and the individual is encrypted in transit. So if somebody dips a straw into that data stream, they just get gobbledygook, encrypted gobbledygook, and it is all encrypted at rest, and it is subject to constant auditing and penetration testing from third-party auditors in order to ensure that all of these transactions comply with the obligations the bank has under all of that superstructure of existing data privacy law.
Representative Barr, does that satisfy you?
Yes.
Is there anybody else that wants to speak on the bill? Any other questions for members? Seeing none, Representative Smith will give you the final word.
Mr. Chair, members, I appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Smith. And with that, Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 1609, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, everyone. With that, we are done with our agenda for the day. But this could be our last meeting for the year. So I don't know where Santa is, our page. She left. Well, thank you, Santa. And to Jamie and Chelsea and John and Betsy and Ms. Pompu and everybody else that's helped, thank you very much. I think it's been a good year, and I hope I don't see you again. No, I'm just kidding. I hope we have a lot more meetings. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.
I'm sorry the lead wasn't here to say thank you.
That's all right. No worries.
I'll say it. Thank you.
Thank you. De facto lead.
On premise. So,